A spoonful of data.
Hello and welcome to another episode of A Spoonful of Data. My name is Mona Schrodel and I'm joined by my irreplaceable colleague, Will Richmond Coggan.
Hello and welcome not only to our listeners in the UK, but also to various listeners that I see from our podcast app we have around the world, including in Singapore, Australia, the US, Canada, India and Italy. Although I gather a startling number of those are friends and family of Mona's.
That's all right. So this week we are talking about the energy consumption of AI, and it made me think of the fact that it's 4 years since the first lockdown. And I don't know about you, Will, but one of the startling revelations of lockdown to me was just how much rubbish I was producing. And when the bins weren't being collected, how quickly it all accumulated. And in a way, there is a parallel to be drawn to the energy consumption of AI and that experience, because you don't normally see it. You don't see the energy consumption of AI, and you don't normally see your rubbish piling up, because that's very efficient. Somebody comes and takes it away and it's out of sight, out of mind. It just conveniently vanishes.
Yeah, that's such a good point. The environmental impact of AI is one of those things that people are starting to talk about now, but has been slightly lost in all of the hype around the capabilities of the technology.
It made me think about how is it measured and who pays for it. And you found a great article that looked at the life cycle of AI. I've got it in front of me now. And the four stages were, one, the production of the systems, then the transport, then the operations, and then the end life stages. So production, and I can't say, for all that I'm immersed in AI, I can't say I've ever really thought about what goes into building the hardware.
Yeah, there's a number of different aspects to that. Firstly, you've got the physical data centers. In order to run AI, in order to be able to train models and so forth, you've got to have a physical facility where you can operate all of the computers. And that's disruptive in itself. But then you've got the chips, and the chips require all sorts of rare earth metals and other materials that need to be extracted from the earth. And with mining, there's always an environmental impact on that. Part of production, once you've extracted those raw materials, is then that you've got to assemble them. So you've got to have factories, and the factories are going to undoubtedly be producing waste products. They'll have an energy consumption of their own when you're manufacturing sort of large quantities of these chips. And then, of course, there's the actual process of getting all of the things to the facilities and installing them. That brings us on to the second of the four stages in the life cycle, that which was about transportation. The energy cost there, I suppose you've got shipment costs, you've got freight, both road transport, potentially sea transport, if you've got chips being manufactured in the Far East and then moved across.
So the transport stage is obviously a part of that cycle, but that isn't where the real bulk of the energy consumption happens.
Yeah, absolutely. It'll be a one-off cost, probably. It'll be getting everything shipped, and you'll need replacement parts delivered from time to time. But in the grand scheme of things, relatively sort of manageable costs, not ones that should be forgotten about, but not enormous.
So the chips themselves probably won't cost that much to transport. But is there any specific consideration for where the chips are going to be used and housed, and where the data center should be? Or could it be anywhere? Could it be next door to me?
One of the things that I suppose is a consideration is you need space. The data centers are fairly substantial, and they tend to be located away from residential areas because they're not necessarily terribly attractive to look at. And as you say, people might have concerns about the sort of heat production and so forth. But they need to be close to a good supply of water. What's happening is that often they're being built in quite out of the way places. And that has positives in terms of it's probably a land use that otherwise wasn't going to get used. But it can have negative implications because the demand for water, and we'll come on to why there's this demand for water in a minute, but That demand for water is drawing water away from other uses in that area, which it might be agricultural, it might be supplying water to out-of-the-way villages for drinking water and things like that. So that impact can be quite disruptive.
Ah, but now we get onto the operation stage, because if I knew that every time I was asking the internet silly questions, there was going to be some heat generated right next door to me, I might think twice about it, because it has a direct impact on me. The same that during lockdown, I thought twice about how much waste I was generating that I didn't really need to generate.
Yeah, putting it in your face and making you conscious of it will make a difference. I think we probably saw that over lockdown as well, to some extent, that people would initially be struck by things that they hadn't noticed before. You mentioned about waste collection and things like that. But quite quickly, people adjusted to the different way of operating. One of the things around lockdown, thinking about the environmental impact, was that we saw almost at once the impact of everyone getting off the roads. There was far less in the way of fuels being burned, carbon dioxide being pumped into the atmosphere. Satellite imagery was showing after that first summer of lockdowns around the world that there'd been a really significant positive impact on the environment. But no sooner was lockdown over, people drifted back to their old ways. And that's because humans tend towards convenience, you know, particularly when they're not being, particularly when they're not being confronted with the consequences of their decisions. So when it comes to the environment.
Before the podcast, you were mentioning to me that in the last 12 months, the general temperature was 1.5 degrees more than had been predicted. And although we're not blaming AI for that, it might have something to do with that, because I was absolutely flabbergasted when I read some of the articles in preparation for this podcast, which was saying just how much energy is being used in training AI models. Mm. And then every time the AI model is asked to perform, there is an energy consumption that we don't see.
Yeah, so that does bring us on to the sort of operational impacts on the environment of AI. And there's two different factors there. First is the training of the models. And the energy demands around that are enormous. Really, it's about running a computer or a network group of computers. And you will know, if you sit with a laptop on your lap for any period of time, or if you sit at a desk and you've got a sort of desktop computer running constantly, you become aware of the heat that it's churning out. And that's because every chip that's operating operates at quite a high temperature. And then there are fans which are basically blowing that air away from them to try and keep them cool enough to keep operating. But that heat's got to go somewhere. Now, in the case of a data center, cooling model is a bit more sophisticated than that. But this is where the water consumption comes in, because enormous quantities of water are being pumped in and around the systems in order to collect heat and carry it away and then dump it elsewhere. But the water consumption is enormous. I think I saw a statistic that said that training a large language model uses the same water as a human might use in 27 years.
Wow.
And every time you use a GPT or something like that to ask a question and you get a response, that's equivalent of taking like a tumbler full of water and just tipping it out on the ground.
That's mind-blowing, actually. And it makes me wonder, this is a very naive question, I apologize to all the listeners, if that much water is being consumed, if the data centers need to be cooled down, that must cost a lot of money. And yet, to the likes of you and I, these tools are made freely available. But every time I ask it to prepare something for me or to give me an answer, there must be a cost associated with it. Why am I not being charged?
You're not being charged because the developers have a vested interest in popularizing it as rapidly as possible and making it ubiquitous. It's a little bit like social media was some years ago. The cost is there, but it's hidden. And for as long as possible, they would like you not to really think about that cost, because they want it to become integrated into your life to become something that you can't really live without. We've seen with social media models that people are becoming increasingly aware about the cost in terms of their privacy that comes from being able to use any of these sort of platforms, that when there's no cost to you of using it, you are the cost, your data is the cost. Now, in the case of AI, some of that is true as well, but equally it's true that what they're hoping is that what's happened over the last year happens, that everyone becomes completely enamored of these new capabilities, and people that use it recreationally or use it as an early adopter just to play around with it, then go into their place of work and they say to their bosses, we've got this amazing tool, why aren't we using it? And what we're hearing from clients is that it's not just a sort of grassroots pressure, but it's also shareholders, directors on the board are hearing about this technology because it's so ubiquitous now. And they're saying, why aren't we using AI? Why aren't we achieving those efficiencies that AI can give us?
Seems to be real peer pressure on going with the trend. You're not cool unless you're using it.
Yeah, you're not cool if you are using it because of the heat it's producing, of course. But more seriously, I think that's right. There's a sort of FOMO, the fear of missing out. And that's not entirely illusory. If you're a business and you're seeing your competitors starting to achieve real efficiencies by co-opting this technology, then you've got to think, if we don't catch up, if we don't get in on this game, maybe we are going to be left behind. But that's just driving ever greater and greater consumption. And what no one is really thinking about when they do that calculation is, what about our ESG obligations? What about the fact that as a business, we've got a target of being net zero by 2030, say, or we've committed to our customers that all of our production is going to be done sustainably? How does AI use fit into that?
I wonder whether there is an element that when people come to look at what can AI do for us and how are we positioning ourselves in relation to the market? Whether upon review, there are things that can be done where you don't use AI and you save a lot of energy and you can actually distinguish yourself from your competitors by pressing that green button and saying, look, we're deliberately not using it. Or yes, we're using it, but we're using it in a targeted, specific way in awareness of how much energy it consumes.
There are definitely positive things that AI can be used for. But I think, just to pick up on that point, there's certainly going to be probably a more sophisticated conversation that happens. Companies that have rushed to say, oh, we're using AI in everything, are going to start having some quite difficult questions to answer from their customers about, okay, what are you doing to offset the carbon impact of that? What are you doing to offset the water impact of that? And I think unless they've thought that through and they've got a really coherent answer for that, it might end up being something that ends up reflecting quite poorly on them, that they've just embraced this technology wholesale.
We keep talking about the hidden dangers of AI using data sets where we don't know where they came from, we don't know how verifiable they are, and the quality of them. Even though the two of us are really immersed in this area now, The energy consumption thing was something that I hadn't really thought about much before. And in equal measure, like with the data that underpins AI, the energy that underpins AI seems to me really nebulous. No one really talks about it. But I don't think there is any sort of transparency from any of the big operators to say, actually, our energy bill this year was X, and it's all to do with us running this new system.
So last year, there was some research that was done by a group at Stanford and MIT, and they produced what was called the Stanford Transparency Index, in relation specifically to large language models. That was a really interesting piece of research because it underscored exactly what you had impressionistically identified, which is that there isn't a lot of data out there about how these things are being done, the impact of them. Now, that was about the data that they were using, how they were training their models, how they were treating their workforce, all sorts of things like that. But it was also about the environmental impact. And they found it very difficult to get any information at all about the upstream, those first couple of stages that we talked about in the sort of four stages of the life cycle, the costs of actually production and development of these models. They were a bit better when it came to the impact of running the model. But even then, there wasn't an awful lot of data available. And then they were very bad indeed at the downstream impact. So at the end of the life of the model, and that's the fourth stage that you mentioned earlier, the cost of disposal and the sort of long-term environmental impacts, which again, very few of these companies were talking about.
As with everything, there's a trade-off. It's not all black and white. It's a grey zone, right? Training a model, even if it does consume a lot of energy, if you can see that once it's trained, it's really going to help reduce the energy consumption on other things because it becomes really clever at understanding what can be done to fix the problem. That's a trade-off I'm almost willing to consider. I think what's really missing is that transparency. How much does it actually cost and why is it free to me? What are other people getting out of it? It's that lack of information, because making informed decisions is much better than making decisions where you are being kept in the dark.
Yeah. I think there's some cautious reason for optimism around that. NVIDIA is one of the biggest chip manufacturers in the world. They have started with their latest GPU model, which is called Blackwell, promoting that particularly around the fact that it is more energy efficient, that it can do more operations, so more sort of calculations on the chip at a lower rate of energy consumption than less efficient models. And so they say that 2000 Blackwell GPUs used over 90 days of training would use 4 megawatts of power. That's still quite a lot, but they're saying that the equivalent using older GPUs would be that you'd need 8,000, so it's sort of four times as many GPUs. And rather than 4 megawatts of power, it would use 15 megawatts of power. Now, in the article that I was reading, they said that's the distinction between the hourly power consumption of 30,000 homes, 15 megawatts of power, versus just 8,000 homes for 2 megawatts of power. And of course, the reality is that there are many times that number of chips in operation and they're running constantly. Now, that said, as I said, it's a sort of cautious note of optimism, because the reality is not everyone is producing chips that are more energy efficient. In the same way, you're seeing a lot of data centers in the US and in Europe using largely sustainable energy, lots of renewables, nuclear energy to power themselves. But elsewhere in the world, you've got other countries that are rushing to catch up around AI. Their energy production is almost exclusively carbon-based.
On the positive note, I have a friend who lives in the countryside, and they had an old factory building down the road, and there was talk about turning that into a data centre. And I know for a fact that the entire village got very excited about it, because they thought, if the people who are running the data centre are clever, they're going to turn it into a heated swimming pool for the locals and could make some extra money out of that. So there are ways, I think, in which the technology can be very sympathetically incorporated. It just needs a bit more thought and transparency, I guess. And the one thing that strikes me about this episode in particular is how many different expertise elements need to come together to make AI happen and to make it more efficient and quicker, faster, better.
Yeah, the way in which I think everyone can help to drive those changes that you're talking about, because they won't happen without any sort of pressure on them. But it's by asking those questions. It's by asking exactly the questions that you're asking. How are you providing this? What is the cost? What's the overall cost? I think it's really important that individuals are doing that. I think it's really important that businesses are doing that, not just because there's a wider sort of social good in ensuring that we understand the environmental impact, but also because just from a more self-interested point of view for companies, a lot of them do have these formal obligations around ESG when they're tendering for work, they're going to be asked questions by their customers. Yes, you're using AI. How are you doing that in a way that's sustainable? And how do you achieve that? I think one other sort of final thought on the positive side of it, there will also come a point where the AI itself becomes sufficiently sophisticated that we can start to ask for help with some of these questions. As you get better at modeling climate, you're going to start to understand the levers that we can pull to manage the impact of climate change. As we get better at modeling energy consumption, we can perhaps start to find better ways of reducing that in the chip architecture, or the way in which cooling can be done more efficiently and without using so much water. Those are all things that AI might potentially be able to help us to come up with more ingenious solutions to. But we've just got to make sure that we don't burn up the planet or dehydrate it before we get to the point where, you know, where those answers can be obtained.
I'm nodding in the background because I can't think of anything better to say as a parting, since I was slightly embarrassed that last week you asked somebody else to sign off, and I fear she did a better job at this than I usually do. You have to deal with my flawed delivery of how people can reach us, which is on social media at A Spoonful of Data. He's nodding, that's good. Or by email, which is spoonfulofdata@proton.me.
Well done. Yes.
Yes, right. I got it right.
Thanks very much, everyone, for listening. We will be back next week. Do get in touch with us, as Mona said, if there's anything you'd like to share in your reactions to this episode. And yeah, come back next week for another Spoonful.
Bye-bye.